This is lesson number 8, The Spiritual Life, 3rd quarter, 2005.
Well, welcome back. This afternoon we're going to look at two lessons. First one, Lord of Our Resources, then Lord of Our Body Temples, both of which tend to make people groan a little bit. Number one, the first one's all about making sure we pay tithe and offering, and the second one's making sure we don't eat chocolate cake. So let's try and do a little better than those kinds of general presuppositions, shall we, and look at what it really is talking about and apply it in the spiritual realm. Well, we're glad for so many people who came out this afternoon. Ellie, would you mind offering the Lord's blessing as we study? Thank you so much.
Dear Father, thank you for yet another opportunity to come here and be together and to praise you and to learn more about you. Please be very close to us, and we thank you. Amen.
And we're glad that Graeme has been able to join us for this afternoon session. We're just making the comment that, unfortunately, the first one on resources often gets associated purely with tithe and offering, and the second one on our body temples is about how we're not supposed to misuse the body for all these things like chocolate cake and the rest. So let's try and get to a more significant set of issues.
On the way in.
You checked the table on the way in, and was it kosher?
I think we need to reinterpret those passages.
All right, well, now the question is, as Gary pointed out before, should we do the eating before we do the lesson, or no, we need to move on. Lord of our resources. The first text that we are given is in Deuteronomy, which is about the promised land. Let's go straight to what Jesus said in Matthew chapter 6, 19 to 21. He said very bluntly, do not store up riches for yourselves here on earth, where moths and rust destroy and robbers break in and steal. Instead, store up riches for yourselves in heaven, where moths and rust cannot destroy and robbers cannot break in and steal. For your heart will always be where your riches are. Your heart will always be where your riches are. So that begs the question, what do you value? What do you see as true riches? And I don't want to say that California may be necessarily any worse than any part of this glorious nation, but I think if most people will want to vote for the real heart of secular materialism, it might well be here. A very extreme kind of society, a lot of people who are extremely wealthy. You have the Hollywood film industry not a million miles away. You have Silicon Valley. You have all these very rich kind of individuals. What about this whole idea of what do you value? How do we try and work with people who have a surfeit of riches, who have more than enough of this world's goods? Where do you even begin? Well, too often, Christianity has been associated with those who are underprivileged. The Adventist Church was defined in one book that I read, it was the typical cult of the disinherited and suffering poor. And I thought, Loma Linda? There was a disconnect in my mind. Gary?
It's interesting that in the Old Testament, that Abraham, who was considered one of God's friends, obviously was not poor. Job, who God says he will not let me down, yes, he lost all that he had. But then look what happened afterwards. Obviously, I mean, it got reinstated to him. So there has to be a balance between, or at least some kind of reconciliation between these. He obviously used people that had influence. Even Moses, yes, he didn't have a lot of money, but I mean, for a while, he was in the court of the most powerful nation of the world. So
sure.
God used people who had means to have influence. So I think just having wealth in whatever way it's described in of itself, obviously, is neither plus nor minus, but then how do you use it?
Mm-hmm.
And some people say, well, you give it away. You know, that's how you use it. Well, that doesn't seem to be necessarily responsible use by giving away. How do you know that whoever you give it away to is going to use it responsibly?
Right. And everything that you need to do takes some kind of funding, doesn't it? There is always a need for the support of God's cause. Why do we even ask for the tithe and the offering? What is the tithe supposed to be for? Well, for every 10 tithe payers or are paying a legitimate tithe, then you should be able to employ one minister because you're getting a tenth from 10 people, and so on. That's what it's there for. What is the offerings for? To support the work of the church. Even this organization that we're part of here, which Sherry and Gary have been funding for so long, that's where they've chosen to put their funding, and others among you too. It does cost to produce the materials, to send them out, to do this, to put it on the web and all those other things. It doesn't happen by accident. And as Gary says, if you say, well, let's just give it away, are you even then being responsible with the money that you have? And are you directing it in the right way? What does God really ask us to do? He says to be good stewards. What does that mean? I think that God is always asking us to do the same thing in every area of life. And that's summed up in one word. Think. And that's the hardest thing for us, isn't it? I actually have to think about something. I don't want to have to think about it. I just want to do it. No, he says, think about it. And that means that when you're making decisions about how you use your resources, whether it's resources of funding, of time, or whatever other things you have, you should be thinking about how you direct it, what you should be doing with it. Eric Hoffer's quote there at the beginning of page 7, you can never get enough of what you don't need to make you happy. Should we try that again? You can never get enough of what you don't need to make you happy. So you keep trying to get enough of what you don't need to make you happy, which is pointing out the fact that material wealth and the accumulation of possessions isn't really the way to achieve true happiness. You remember the man building those bigger barns, and the Lord says to him, you know, you're foolish. You've invested in the things of this world, and yet you are not rich toward God. So how do we become truly rich? Is it by just giving away everything we have, giving it to the poor, taking vows of poverty? What do you think, Bill?
One of the thoughts that strikes me is, and maybe we're getting to this in a little bit, the idea that we have nothing without God. And so if we're going to be good stewards, the unfaithful steward isn't one that's overcome by the evils of wealth. They already were. So the faithful steward is plugged in, thinking as it may be, with God in their lives. So I think one of the first things we can do is orient towards God. And I know that means a lot of different things to a lot of different people.
Yeah, I think if you go back and look there in Deuteronomy 8, we won't take the time to read that passage, but God is basically saying to them, I'm going to take you to the promised land, but don't forget it's down to me. And it's not about how clever and wise and good people you are. It was I who gave you the ability to have wealth. And as you accumulate the gold and silver and the land and all the resources, don't then think that you are self-sufficient and you don't need me anymore. As often is the case, people will say, your need for God goes down as your bank balance goes up, and that's a tragedy. Yes, Lisa.
The Sabbath is a wonderful way to calibrate us to the economy of heaven. We spend so much of our time in our consumer society trying to make money, and even our time becomes money. We say that time is money. And we, if we're not making money, we're finding ways of spending money. Yesterday we had to go to the airport, and on the way back we decided to stop at that new Victoria Gardens Mall. I'd heard all about it. And I was stunned at how large it was, and it's just a mecca just for shopping. It has theaters and shops and restaurants. But the more astounding thing is it's only a mile from the Ontario Mills Mall. Like, how could we have yet another huge, sprawling consumer mecca right by Ontario Mills Mall? But the Sabbath breaks in on that and helps us reevaluate what's really valuable in the economy of heaven: relationships, worship, rest, enjoying what God has given us, enjoying the blessings that we already have, not just the things that we have.
Right, and this is where the value comes in, yes.
You probably discussed this before I came, but the verse, the love of money is the root of all evil. I think poor people love money just as much as those who have some. In fact, they work even harder to get some. So it,
the issue is the love of it.
Love.
Yeah, the desire to have it. Yeah. Sherry, you had a thought.
I was just thinking, as Lisa was talking, Anna and I had gone to that same mall, and it was our first time to go. But what we did there was find the waffle maker that you all had waffles from this morning. So I think it's a little more complex, and we also got some gifts for some people that had been very kind to us. So I think most of it's in our heads. It's not the malls that are bad. It's not some of these other things that are bad. It's the attitude towards them and how we use them.
And I have to say, and here I'm going to be extremely self-righteous, I have a wonderful attitude to shopping malls. I don't need them, and I don't like to go there. And so therefore, I must be extremely virtuous. Is that not right? They don't tempt me whatsoever. People who become shopaholics, I don't understand them at all. I have no desire to go shopping. My mother inoculated me against that by dragging me around these shops as a child, and I have no desire. If I want to buy something, I'll go and buy it and come home again. Or even better, I'll go online, click it with my mouse, and then it'll arrive on my doorstep in 2 or 3 days' time. Why do I need a shopping mall? They're anathema to me.
Would you take Anna?
It's not whether I take Anna, but sometimes she does take me, usually under a great deal of protest. You see, because it doesn't appeal to me, I can seem very virtuous. As Graham always says, with some of the, what can we call it, the lusts of the flesh, as you get older, you don't have any desire anymore, but just because you're getting older.
At last.
Victory at last. Yes, Bob.
Okay, you might like to study, you might like a bookstore. Could that be a weakness?
Well, I suppose we could look at that, but that's, of course, education and erudition, something which is very much a tool for the scholar. And we actually do get a book allowance from the General Conference, so that must be that it's okay. You see how you can rationalize, can't you? Yes, Bill.
Pastor Ortiz tells an interesting story. Juan Carlos Ortiz is a well-known evangelist in Argentina, and his book has been translated into English called The Disciple. And in it, he tells a very interesting story about an imaginary dealing with God and a Christian who really, really wants that pearl of great price. It goes something like this: I want this pearl. How much is it? Well, the seller says, it's very expensive. Well, how much? A very large amount. Do you think I could buy it? Well, of course, anyone can buy it. But you said it's very expensive. Yes. Then how much is it? Well, everything you have, the seller said. All right, I'll buy it. Well, how much do you have? I'll write it down. Well, I have $10,000 in savings. Okay, $10,000, he wrote it down. What else? Well, that's about it. Nothing more? Well, let's see. I've got a few dollars in my pocket. Let's see, $120. Okay, we'll take that. What else do you have? Well, nothing. That's about all. Where do you live? He's digging. Well, in my house. Oh, you have a house. Yes, the house too. He writes that down. You mean I have to live in my camper? Oh, you've got a camper. Let's write that down too. What else? But I'll have to sleep in my car. Oh, you have a car, okay. Well, yeah, I have two cars. Okay, all right, both of two cars. What else? Well, you've got my money, my house, my camper, my cars. What more do you want? Are you alone in this world? No, I have a wife and two children. Okay, I'll take your wife and children. What else? I've got nothing left. You've got everything. Suddenly the seller exclaims, oh, I almost forgot. I want you too. Everything becomes mine. Wife, children, house, money, car, camper, and you. Oh, now listen. I will allow you to use all these things for all the time being. They're all mine, just as you are. And whenever I need any of them, you'll give them up. Because you see, I'm really the owner. Quite a story.
It does make us think about where we place our value and to what degree does God have sovereignty, ownership, control over these things, and yet does not enforce that, which again speaks about God. We so often think about ourselves and how much we have. But is that really true? What do we have? And how much can we take with us? Yes, Joanne.
Well, talking about Victoria Gardens, I happen to be the work experience teacher that does work permits for Altaloma High School, which is right near Victoria Gardens. And it's been a very interesting experience as an Adventist, where in a community that does not have an Adventist church, goes on a commercial frenzy as the city is pushing Shop in Rancho, Spend in Rancho, and almost if the shoppers don't shop, they get depressed and they want the people to come out. The students are also being pressed to take more than one job because the worker pool, it's hard to find enough workers, low-paid workers, to staff all those stores. But most people are working themselves to a frenzy to buy all the things money can buy.
And isn't this just a strange thing? Did you spend all this time trying to collect, amass all this money so you can do what? Go down to the local shopping mall and spend it all again. We have so much, and yet I would like to venture the question as to how many of these people truly are happy. Maybe think they're happy. How do they know whether they're really happy? How do they know if there's anything else? Yes, right.
Bill related about the pearl of great price, but I have to take a little bit of umbrage to it. It almost sounds like the seller was a used car salesman in the sense that, oh, you want it. Okay. What else can I get out of you? I don't picture God as acting in that sort of bait and switch type manner. I picture him as saying, it's all mine to begin with, but I'm going to let you use it. I'm going to let you have it. I want you to use it wisely, but I'm not going to force you to use it wisely. And not springing things on you down the road, but rather telling you up front, this is what's going on, and I don't want you to feel like I'm trying to micromanage you or throw a guilt trip on you or anything like that. If you spend money in the areas that I recommend that you spend it in, it will be the greatest possible benefit for both you and the others around you.
I think he was really trying to answer the question, what is the cost of discipleship? And what is the cost of discipleship? Can you put a dollar tag on it even? There is a totality involved there. And I agree, you perhaps could tell the story differently, but the point that is being made is that there is a cost there that is involved in all of this. And yet the value or the price tag is one that is very different to the way that the world would value things. When you talk about pearl of great price, it's almost playing into that consumerism, I have to have it mentality, which is maybe why Jesus told it, because there are so many people who are like that. But at the end, even if you had that pearl, what? Are you going to put it on display? Are you going to keep it in your pocket? Are you going to hide it in your safe? He's really trying to tell you, he is the pearl. That's the point. And it is valueless. Well, it's at least priceless. You can't value it in today's or in this world's terms. And that's why Jesus, in every single statement that he talks about values, he reverses the values of this world and says, mine are the exact opposite. And I did that little piece at the end on Mirrorland. He switches it all around. It's completely different. What we value and what we think is important, God says, that's not the true value, and that's not what really is important. Let me explain this for you about what is really important and where you should put your values, because where you have your value, that is where you're going to place your heart. Lisa, I think you want to have thoughts.
I'm indebted to Richard J. Foster for these ideas in his book, The Disciplined Christian Life, Christian Reflections on Money, Sex, and Power. The first edition of that book, by the way, was just Money, Sex, and Power, and a number of people bought that book and returned it. You can get these on the internet very cheaply because they thought the book was about how to get more money, sex, and power rather than...
In which order?
The Disciplined Christian Life and Christian Reflections on Money, Sex, and Power. It's a very good book. He says that people use money, sex, and power to gain the things that only God can give. They become false gods. And his chapter on money is really really very well written. He says that we should have a relationship not to love it, or in a way that many do. They use it to gain a sense of self-esteem, security for the future, to control other people, to have prestige, to feel important. But he says, laugh at it, step on it, use it. You mention here the parable of the unjust steward. That's from Luke 16. I love that parable because Jesus, at the end of this parable, says something that's really astounding. He actually commends the unjust steward, and so does the Lord of the house. He commends him. Commends him for recognizing what money can do. And the very last counsel that he gives in verse 9 is, I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourself, so that when it is gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings. So it's counseling us to be shrewd in the way we use money. So Sherry used it to buy waffle iron that blessed everybody here. There are resources that we put into the offering plate every week that is going to invest in the next life to get people to be saved, to get to know about the gospel message. When my mother read that book, she said she tried it. She took out a $20 bill and she laughed at it and she stepped on it. And then she picked up a man, a young fellow that was walking along the road and hitchhiking. I scolded her for that because she's elderly. But she did anyway. And when she gave him a ride, talked to him, found out that he didn't have any money. And so when he got out of the car, she gave him a $20 bill. It changed the relationship to money. It was not something to grasp, something to sacrifice your life for, but to use in God's business, to gain friends, to gain influence over people, to turn them towards God, to eternal things of value.
Yeah, because it's a tool. That's the whole point. And how you use it is the key. It can be used for yourself, to bless yourself, which is a very selfish way, or it can be used, Ellen White in FLB, whichever one that stands for, 160. All we possess is the Lord, and we are accountable to him for the use we make of it. Money has great value because it can do great good. And then she goes on to say, but money is of no more value than sand, only as it is put to use in providing for the necessities of life, in blessing others, and advancing the cause of Christ. In other words, you have to use it, and you have to use it and think about the way that you're using it. Because, as Graham said there at the beginning, it's not that whether you have money or not, it's your attitude towards it. These are saying the love of money. If that's your main focus, and that's what you really value, then that's where your heart is going to be. Yeah, Bill.
One thing would be, how does God use his resources?
Mm-hmm. Good question.
And one of the examples of that is Philippians 2. Christ gave up everything he had. He gave it away. He spent it all. That goes back to the pearl of great price parable, which I think first is telling us that the kingdom of heaven, God, views each individual human being as a pearl of great price that he purchased and gave it all up for. I think when we begin to believe in that we're really that loved, the use of our own resources, life, every fiber that we are begins to change. Otherwise, we're just doing the external trappings without entering into that relationship. So I think first we have to believe that we are a pearl of great price to God, that he gave up all of his resources, spent it all, to enter into relationship with me, i.e. every individual. Mm-hmm. And I think that then begins to change how we view. We could sacrifice all the cattle, all the sheep, thousands of them, but what does God want? The spirit, the individual.
And that shows you that the value that God places on it is related to very different concepts to what we place value on as we look around it. By the way, when we read that part about the love of money, that's from Hebrews 13:5. Read on, as Graham would always say, read on. Keep your lives free from the love of money and be satisfied with what you have. That's the corollary. Then it says, for God has said, I will never leave you, I will never abandon you. In other words, don't be preoccupied with gaining money as your security, because that's what you're wanting to do with the money, trying to secure your life. No, it's God who is going to be your security. You don't have to trust in your bank balance.
Ellen White had a lot to say on this subject. Mm. She was a good businesswoman herself, and she knew the power of money to get some jobs done. She wrote to one young man and said, by now you should be owning some property of your own. he was too contented with what he had. No, you ought to want some property. All those have to be put together. But the most delicate aspect of this is when leading brethren in the church felt that they could spend her money more wisely than she could. And the idea was, if you're truly dedicated, you'll give your money to the church. Now, how dare one say anything now? She said, no. After you have paid your tithe and your regular support, the rest of it, God has entrusted to your care, and you should not, in a lazy way, hand it over to someone else and thereby shuck the responsibility. You're responsible now. No, God expects you to use your money wisely. That's something, when you read that over and over, you can imagine the interesting ways in which the disposition of one's personal funds enters into this.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to ask some of the younger generation here, because from what I understand from the treasurer there at the General Conference, the problem is coming that while the older folk in the church do tend to provide reasonably with their tithe and their offerings, it doesn't seem to be working that way with the younger generation. And there's great concern at headquarters that the funds are going to be dropping off very quickly as the faithful older members move off the scene and the younger generation comes on. What's going on with that? What is the change in the attitude? What is the difference in the mentality? Is it that we don't think we should pay tithe anymore? We shouldn't give it offerings? Or is it a concern over those who might be administering it? I wonder. Anybody want to volunteer and think about that who's below the age of 30 or so? Not wanting to put anybody on the spot. Kristen, you can be spokesperson.
Unfortunately, I haven't had a job yet where I've made money, so I don't really have a huge opinion about this, but I would say that if you're interested in what people my age think, I just think there's a general lack of feeling of responsibility for keeping up the church. I think, mm-hmm. like especially around here, there's so many churches that when people come out here to go to school, you kind of jump around. You know, you might go to one church for a week, but you don't feel responsible to, I don't know.
Pay for it.
Yeah, that's my thoughts. I don't know.
We don't make money now.
Uh-huh.
You know, we're all on loans, at least I am,
yeah.
in medical school.
Yeah. So your disposable income is somewhat limited, you might say.
Yes.
Well, sometimes I've heard the thought of some people I know growing up, like Sabbath school teachers and such, where it was almost the attitude, like, whatever you do when you grow up, make sure you love what you do and try not to make too much money. You know, it's kind of the undertone to it. And I just always thought that was so odd, because to me, and like you were saying before, it's not the money that's bad. I think that we do have a responsibility to, if we can make money and use it wisely, to have money, because it's what we do with it, like we said before, that's good or bad.
Yeah. Yeah. Another thing where you maybe confirm or deny for me is that folk are thinking more about where they want to put their money, and they want to target it to particular projects. And to just throw it into some vast black hole that is called the General Conference Treasury doesn't really cut it anymore. They want to know who they're helping, have some idea that this is really doing what they say, because there's been, not in the GC, of course, but in some other areas, folk have misused the funds and things have gone awry. So I think that's a very healthy attitude, to ask the questions. Now, of course, the General Conference is trying to think of ways in which to address that by saying, well, these are the specific projects, this is the information, the Office of Mission Awareness is developing materials to say, well, by the way, when you pay your 13th Sabbath, or when you give this money, whatever, this is what is happening with your money. Because I think it is right that we should know, and as Graham was saying, not just hand off responsibility because there are people up there who know better what to do with it. I think it's really an important part of Christian stewardship to know what to do and how to put that money into the right place.
Yes, Bill. Just a brief comment. You cannot sow irresponsibility and then reap the confidence of the people that have watched this happen. Enough said. Wilbur Reese writes a painfully penetrating sarcasm when he says, "I would like to buy $3 worth of God, please. Not enough to expose my soul or disturb my sleep, but just enough to equal a cup of warm milk or a snooze in the sunshine. I don't want enough of him to make me love a black man or pick beets with a migrant. I want ecstasy, not transformation. I want the warmth of the womb, not a new birth. I want a pound of the eternal in a paper sack. I'd like to buy just about $3 worth of God, please. And I think sometimes we are kind of like this, where we want to give him what's left over. We put a few dollars in the offering plate. But sometimes I think when it comes to our means, they're not really given to him. And that's something I think all of us have to face individually. I'm plagued with this. I'm plagued with the fact that I wonder if I really need to keep that money in that retirement fund. Should I put it into something else? Mm-hmm. And these are the things that you think about. And if you don't think about them, I don't think you're really thinking.
No.
All of us need to be careful we don't fall in this danger of just wanting to throw God just a few leftovers.
No. It's a question of responsibility, as we said before. It's a question of making sure that we do think about it, that it isn't just happening by accident or by habit. I think as we think about the direction where we want to put our resources, and please don't let us get hung up on money, because that's always the way it seems. And I hate it, and I know, I mean, Sherry and I were talking just a little while ago about this. The appeals that go out there for funding can be just so nauseating. It's not the way that we should be operating. And I really do believe that God has, you know, cattle on the thousand hills are mine, he says. If something is going to happen and it needs funding, he will make sure it works out. He will impress people. He will work with it. And I think the gospel is demeaned when it is tagged to this idea of some money-making venture. And I certainly don't want to. This organization's never gone that route. Make that really clear. Never gone that route. And I think that's something that I particularly value, because it's not about the money. It's about where the value is. And even more important, as Lisa was saying, than the money, is where do you put your time? I think that's really, that speaks far more even than the money. I really do. Everybody who's in this room, everybody who's listening on tape or CD or on the internet, that is where they're placing their value of the most precious commodity, which is your time, which is so finite and so pressured and so constrained that you want to, the fact that folk, that Gerald flew down here just so he'd be part of this meet, he wants to do that. And others, I see Noni over there, I mean, came here because she wants to be part of it. It's about the fact that we value something in the ministry that we want to contribute to, we want to be part of it. That's where I think we look at our resources.
I think there's another little aside from that, in that as we become more and more aware, if you're really trying to use your time and your resources carefully because you have a strong mission, a strong goal, a strong focus, then you're also very aware if where you give your money doesn't seem to have that same kind of a focus, or it may be used in ways that you feel, if you're judging on priorities, maybe you wouldn't choose to give your money that way. And sometimes within a church situation, if you don't vote in those ways, you're actually enabling something that's harmful, that isn't really helpful to God. Now, I realize that's a very sensitive thing to say, but I think the more you become aware of strong goals and of a desire to do things well, you're also aware when those goals or those values are not shared elsewhere, and why would you choose to give your money there?
Yeah. Which means you have to be thinking again. And that's the whole point. I really don't think that the Lord is too preoccupied with this as long as we're thinking about it. That's not just in this conversation, but in all these aspects. If we are not thinking about what we believe, why we believe it, reviewing the foundations, reviewing the evidence, thinking about what the evidence shows us. If we're not doing that, then he really doesn't have much of an opportunity to get there and to work with us. But if we are thinking, then he has the chance to come in. How many times have you been through a Sabbath and never thought about God once? And you say, well, no, I said the prayers and I sung the hymns and I heard the sermon, but did you think about God? And I can honestly confess, I've gone through a Sabbath and it's rolled right through. And you didn't really think. Graham.
I like the way the conversation has put things in a balanced way. Mm. I hope those whom God has blessed with financial resources are not feeling covered with guilt. I better get rid of this stuff so the neighbors won't think I'm loving money. To look at the lives of some people who have recognized this as a very influential talent. In a way, I envy these folk who can have the godlike experience of seeing a needy situation and saying, I can do something about that right now. And I've watched some people do that for years. And they often, we don't hear about these folk, but behind the scenes, they're keeping all kinds of things running. It's just marvelous. I've watched it at Loma Linda, where some people who never want the headlines are so generous with this, that, and the other. They consider it really is a godlike experience to see a need and be able to say, I can handle that.
Absolutely. And I think that applies to everybody in this room just for being here too. They say, I get blessed, but I'm blessing others through this. And that by my participation, I'm using my time, my talents, my knowledge, my whatever it might be, to advance this cause, because this is a totally supportive ministry. If it wasn't, how could I be here as a representative of the organized official church? It's a supportive mission. It's a supportive of Sabbath school. It's going out to help people teach Sabbath school, to get the most out of the Sabbath school, to think about what the Sabbath school is all about. And so I'm just so delighted to be part of that. And yet this is not under directly the auspices of the organized church. For me, you could have to say, well, it doesn't matter because it's supporting it. It's another area, another branch of the Adventist Church of members who are coming together to say, we can do something to improve the experience. And we can do it in our little way that we think is useful. And so long as it's useful for folk, it will continue. It's only because it's useful that it's working. If it wasn't useful, we'd all be wasting our time.
So highly enjoyable.
Well, there is that little aside to it too. Isn't it interesting how when things are really useful, they become the most enjoyable? Why? Because you're not just thinking of pleasure for yourself, but because you're sharing. What is the best thing to be doing? Isn't it to give, to share, to contribute to others? It's nice to receive. Here we get almost down to the platitudes, but it's still true. It is more blessed to give than to receive, isn't it? And to see the delight on the faces of others when you've been able to help is something that all of us truly value. And we should delight it. Yes, right.
There's this temptation to say, well, I gave at the office and write a check, because that is the easiest thing to do sometimes. When we have an opportunity, generally have a unique opportunity as individuals to see a need that many times others can't see or can't even imagine is there, and to make a difference in that area, whether it be through time, money, or other resources that we can apply to that situation. And I want to echo some of the concerns that you raised and that others have raised about. You said if 10 people were paying 10% of their income, then that would be one more pastoral staff. But when you hear things like it takes 4 times the salary worth of tithe for a church to have a pastor there because 3/4 of that is going somewhere else, you go, excuse me? And one church we attended one time was publishing their books in the bulletin, and they said, we need some help paying off net XX from 3 years ago, and we are currently on a plan for doing the net for this year, and we're spending money, and we still have debts from 3 years ago that we have to pay off. And it was those examples that made my wife and I choose to look into some other areas where we can better direct what we consider to be God's gift to us so that it's more effectively used. And so to kind of answer the question, maybe from the perspective of somebody who still has student loans but is out of school, that is something that we definitely take us in consideration of.
Yeah, and I think it's absolutely right that you should think that way. I think it's also extremely important, and the organized church needs to think about that very definitively, because all the other ministries are dependent on the organized church, and if that fails, then what happens to everything else? So we need to think about the core ministry of the church, and that has to be supported. Without that, then Sabbath school isn't going to be happening, and this little group isn't going to be happening in that same kind of sense. Maybe it goes a different route, maybe it happens a different way, but that's why they're now taking it very seriously, that people know what's happening, where the money's going, to have transparency, to have accountability. I don't know too much about all the books of the GC and all the rest of it. I can speak very specifically about what we used to do there in South England and the British Union because I was far more intimately involved. And one thing I can say is that we had a generally very satisfied membership because they knew what was going on. They saw the books, they understood it, they could see what we were doing. When I first joined the pastoral ministry in the South England Conference, way back, all these many, many years ago, 1982, as long ago as that, the budget was secret. Can you believe that? Just 23 years ago? A secret, you know, nobody was allowed to see the budget. Only the treasurer and maybe the president or whatever got to see the budget. It wasn't something that was published. So I think it was the very next year they made the momentous decision to publish the budget. And we had it explained to us with overheads at the workers' meeting. And can you believe, I mean, everybody wanted to ask a question. Everybody was vitally interested because finally we now knew what the budget was. And do you know what? It was the most unexciting thing because we actually got to understand why we couldn't do this and why we couldn't do that because we didn't have the money. Because we could see all the numbers on the chart. And the very next year, do you know how many questions there were? no point in looking at that. Everybody knows that now. It's not secret. So when you have transparencies, when you see the things, I think that really helps the members to say, why can't we have more ministers? Well, it's because it's only 30% of members are paying a, quote, honest tithe. So that's why. And I think as you do that, then you gain respect. You gain some degree of better ownership that the members do see what's happening. So I would always plead for total transparency, total honesty, total directness, and just let people know where things are. When you get to that stage and then you go and ask the membership, can you help us with this? I think at that point they're going to say, sure, I can see the need for it.
I have great confidence in the Adventist people. You show them a genuine need. You show them a situation that needs their help. And they can see that it's not just a lot of words. You see money coming out of the woodwork that you didn't know was going to be there. I've seen these kind of things happen. They're very, very generous people, really. But they've been shortchanged once in a while, and they're a little bit gun-shy. If I could tell a quick story. When I was in practice, I had a number of wealthy patients, and several years ago in my dental office, one person I think of particularly, because this guy, well, let's say it this way, he could buy and sell me, or he could even afford to keep me. He was so wealthy. And in telling him of some of his dental problems, he would have gotten on his knees and pled with me if he weren't quite so dignified. But his thing was, Doc, please save my teeth. I didn't say it to him, but under my breath, in my thoughts, I thought, you foolish so-and-so. You have spent your whole life gaining all this wealth. And in the process of doing it, you've lost several marriages. You've alienated your family. You have made a lot of enemies. Your health is shot, and your teeth are going to go down the drain. And you know, we talked about time as well. There is a time when you can interact with your children. That time is gone. It's gone forever. There's a time when you can do things. It's gone forever. And if you don't use your wealth, whether it's time or money, properly, you've lost it. There's opportunities that come when you can financially help something. If you don't do it then, later, it's too late. And I think we need to learn the lesson from other people, if we can, much better than learning it in our own lives, that there's a time and there's a reason when we should do what we have to do and put our priorities in the proper relationship.
And I can also tell you that there's nothing more wonderful for a pastor or a church administrator when they see folk rallying and supporting, because it's an endorsement of what we're trying to do. And we can talk about all the various people who've helped support here. It's just astounding how it works out. And that's when you really have the confidence that this is really happening, it's really working. And not because you thought that this was the important thing to do, but as you've come together, as you put it all together, suddenly it really does take off. I want to give credit to Graham and pay a tribute to Graham for his leadership, his good counsel, and his ideas over all these many years, 30 plus years of even just doing the tapes and plus all the things before that. And I'm sure you weren't thinking of doing it because it was going to be a money-making scheme, but simply because it was something worthwhile doing. Any regrets over the years as to what you were doing?
What you just said suggests a new idea, maybe. We hadn't thought about the money side.
the very fact that you can say that with a big grin on your face, I mean, that speaks volumes. There is something so unpleasant when money gets linked to the whole spreading of the gospel thing. Yes, you do need money to pay for halls, to rent, to do all these things, but as Gary said, I think it was last night, maybe we're not always spending our money most wisely in that situation. What I like is the fact that really fundamental evangelism costs nothing at all in terms of money. It's me speaking with you, you speaking with someone else, that other person speaking with someone else. And ultimately, even though things like Bibles obviously are important to have, and spiritual literature, and maybe a video cassette or an audio cassette, they're all useful tools. When it comes down to it, Jesus showed us the way, and it was simply talking to people and sharing with them where they were. And that's not anything that needs vast amount of money. It just needs commitment, conviction, it needs a vision. And it needs an investment of time, but all the money in the world can't buy you that. So I think it helps us as we rethink what is really our priority. Where should we really be going? I like that quote there. It's the third one on page 8. If the eye is kept single, the whole body will be full of light. If the spiritual vision is clear, unseen realities will be looked upon in their true value, and beholding the eternal world will give added enjoyment to this world. If you really want to enjoy this world, if you really want to be happy in the here and now, you've got to be able to see the oncoming, the onrushing eternal world that is about to break in. When Jesus said, the kingdom of God is within you, also be translated, is among you. It's already here. We often talk afterwards as we're enjoying one another's company, saying, you know, this is just a little foretaste of what heaven's going to be like. And I really do think so. Do you think we're going to have to stop talking about God just because we're there in heaven? We could get some instant checks. Is that really true? Well, let's go and ask the Lord about it. But I think we're still going to be doing these kinds of things, still going to be talking about it with great deal more insight and practical example. But I don't think we're going to give up this process of learning, of studying, of delighting in what the Lord is. Yes, Gary.
Christ obviously had some kind of financial support,
mm-hmm.
because they talk about Judas had been the treasure. Well, you're not a treasure unless you have some means that you have to mm-hmm. take care of. There were 13 people wandering around the country for 3.5 years, maybe more. They have to eat. They have to sleep. Now, maybe they just slept out. But, I mean, there's expense in that. But except where they talk about him eating with various people and being invited home, there's really zero mention about how this whole ministry was financed, because that was apparently fairly irrelevant. Did people feed them? Did they donate money or whatever? There's just nothing said about that at all. But obviously you have to have some support for that many people to exist for that long a period of time. But yet there's just no, that I can tell, indication how that came about. Certainly Christ never asked for,
no.
I'm hungry, can somebody feed me?
Yeah, and apparently there were some, isn't it true that there were some of the ladies, the richer ladies, were providing support and things like that?
No, but the actual mechanism and stuff, it just seems, it totally...
As you say, I don't think it was something that needed much attention or explanation.
Well, they didn't have a treasurer.
That's what Gary's saying, so they had to have some treasure to be treasurer of.
Yeah, but I mean, but he was the crook.
And you are thereby providing some kind of syllogism, are you? Is there some comparison?
Essentially, he's the one that had a preoccupation with money, and he's the one who made sad shipwreck of everything.
Yeah.
Jesus kept him on the team right till he took himself out of the running.
Yeah. And it seems that it wasn't Jesus who appointed him to be treasurer, but the other disciples said, oh, he's good with the money, let's give it to him.
See? There's a lesson in that case for Judas.
Absolutely. Yes.
He also is the one who felt that Jesus was wasting many opportunities to expand his movement. He was the one who wanted to crown him king.
And if you look at it, that goes to the heart of this whole idea of the resources and wise stewardship, because you could even make some kind of case for that. If you didn't really understand what Jesus' mission really was and what he was trying to achieve. Because if you really did think that Jesus' primary mission were here was to make a big impact, to convert a lot of people, to good do it and measure it the way that we often tend to want to measure it, how many did he have at the end? When he made his declaration on the evangelistic report, how many numbers did he have? So it is all too easy to mistake the real mission that God had in this world through Jesus and continues to have. So we do need to think very carefully about, you know, often we talk about in accountancy, we talk about the bottom line. What is really the bottom line? Is the bottom line of a balance sheet? Or is it something very, very different?
Jesus was getting advice from his treasurer, the treasury department. The brethren were urging him. Now we call the brethren the leaders. His own brothers, who were the brethren. So his own brethren were urging him to get on with the thing. When he said, I'm not going to make this grand entry here. And they said, well, you'll never amount to anything if you don't go public in a bigger way. So when you've got the treasury department and the brethren, nobody understood why he stood quietly by and waited for something else of greater importance.
Which goes back to what are the things that God values compared to the things that we value. Yeah.
So he was concerned about finishing the work. Question is, what is finishing the work?
Yeah. Finishing what work? Whose work? What is really the work?
When he died, he cried, I finished the work.
Mm-hmm.
And his chief laborers said, it looks as if it is finished, so we might as well go back to fishing. Nobody understood what he was trying to accomplish.
Absolutely right.
And yet he went ahead because he had this larger view of things. And that went back to the great controversy. I think that's the biggest thing that's missing.
Mm-hmm.
It gives meaning to everything.
Absolutely. And that's why... I hope this didn't come across as an exposition of why you need to pay tithe next week or bring in all your donations or whatever else, because that is so far from what this is really all about. Do you think God really needs that? When he says, bring your tithe in, what is that for? Gerald Fillmore says, we need it. What does tithe say? What does offering say? It's actually not to prove anything to anybody else, or even to God, I don't think, but to prove to ourselves we're not the kind of selfish people that we often really are. It's to try and say that I am putting my resources in another direction. that I really do take these things seriously, and I'm not going to use it all on whatever I think I should be doing for myself. I'm going to pick on Noni because she's sitting over in the corner being very quiet, because she's a CPA, and we're now in the month of June, and therefore she has not got too many preoccupations maybe after doing all the tax things up to April 15th. But just from your perspective and thinking about the utility of money, how would you react to this idea? How is the Lord to be the Lord of our resources, as we sum up?
I think it's, as we have often talked about here, we need to keep our focus on God. And if we focus on other things, then we kind of get distracted.
Mm-hmm.
And if we keep our focus on God, and if we keep thinking about Him, and we spend time with Him every day, then other things kind of seem to fall into place, so to speak.
Right. And I don't think we could do any better than to summarize it that way. We need to close and bring this to an end. But let's think about that, because that is really the point, isn't it? That as we keep our focus in that direction, then all these other things, the love of money doesn't apply, our preoccupation with possessions doesn't apply, and even our desire for power and money and sex and all whatever else, you know, that's not the important thing anymore, because we are fixing our eyes upon Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. Let's pray as we close. Heavenly Father, we are just so delighted that you are the one who shows us the true value of things, that as we look at the world and its desire for money and wealth, the whole consumerism cycle, we recognize that that doesn't bring satisfaction, it doesn't bring true happiness, it doesn't bring us any kind of sense of real joy, because it's in things which are impermanent and transitory. We want to look forward to the permanent things, the joys of the kingdom, and we thank you, Lord, that you've shown them to us, that we can truly enjoy that and share that with others around us. May we find our joys in sharing you with people in our community, telling them of what the real value is in life, and may they understand and respond. We pray this in the wonderful name of Jesus, our Savior. Amen.